I was here at camp meeting just for a few minutes, about 20 minutes. It was my first time in Walla Walla, and I fell in love with the place, and I feel very grateful for the opportunity to be back. And this morning I want to share some experiences with you that I hope will change your lives. Not just an impression that you will go away with that it was a good speaker, but something that will be, that will shake you to the inside and make you willing or desirous to experience the same thing. They had their first baby, and they were quite disappointed to find out that he was born with a defective intestine. The intestines were just in pieces. There was no peristaltic activity, no nerves, not the slightest chance that the baby would live. The surgeons operated on the baby 3 times in 2 weeks and finally told the parents, "We have been unable to create what he was not born with. So therefore, you, Father, as a pastor, need to prepare the sermon for the burial." They decided to try one last thing, and that was, let's anoint the baby and see if maybe God can do what man can. So they anointed the baby, and within a few days, the doctor came back and said, "It's amazing. For the first time in its full month of life, it's beginning to have peristaltic activity. The food is progressing normally. We've connected all the intestines together just in case the food could fall through. And the baby began to digest normally." And that's how I first got my lease on life. When I was 1 year old, my parents took me to Bolivia. I lived in the jungles there. My dad was a pastor pilot down in the jungles of Bolivia. There was another missionary family, and they had a cute little daughter, and she became a good friend of mine. She used to raise monkeys. And when I was 8 years old, I already decided who I wanted to marry. So I went and bought a little bottle of perfume. The guy said, "What is that for, little boy?" "That's for my girlfriend I'm going to marry someday." I gave it to her, and I asked her to marry me. She said she would someday, but I was disappointed when her brother came to me and said, "Guess what? My sister doesn't like you. I just saw her putting the perfume on her monkey." And when I found out that one of her favorite things was, "I love you, I love you, I love you, I do, but don't get excited, I love monkeys too," I gave up all hope. 10 years later, I was quite embarrassed when I met her at Southern again, and I said, "Oh my, how embarrassing, you know, to think that I was going to actually marry her, and I'm sure she's forgotten." I found out she hadn't forgotten. In fact, she'd had several other proposals, and she said, "I'm sorry, I'm engaged already." Our parents got together and started conniving, scheming, and it wasn't long till we found out that both sides were very interested that we pursued the relationship just like we were kind of hoping to. And sure enough, we got together, took nursing together, and married halfway through nursing. And as soon as we finished nursing, we took off for the mission field. We didn't have an invitation, so we were just burnt out. I had studied aviation and nursing. I finished an instrument rating, commercial and instructor rating while I was right in the middle of nursing, and I was burnt out. My brain took a vacation. And so we went overseas for a while, decided to come back, work as nurses, and buy an airplane, go back again. Oh, well, you can't hardly have an airplane without learning how to maintain it. So back to school again. No invitations to work after we finished, so continued on with computer science. And then we did get a call. We got 3 of them at the same time. We looked at the 3 needs and we said, well, the one in Mexico, there was Brazil, Peru, and Mexico, and we decided the one in Mexico was the one with the biggest need. And so we went to Mexico, and there began our service. But as I look back on those early days, I realize what a hard job I gave my angels. I remember we used to milk 200 heads of cows every day, between 8 of us. And afterward, we would take turns riding bulls to see who could stay on the longest. And one of the bulls threw me off and came back and stomped all over me till they drove him up. I was wondering I didn't get killed. And another time, another wild cow was running after me, and they called my attention, and I took off over the top. I jumped over the corral just as the horns hit my feet. And that was really close. as a student pilot. I was riding along with a friend. I was in the passenger seat just going along for the ride. But after we landed, the landing gear collapsed and the plane took off across the field and hit a combine head on at 70 miles an hour. And that little airplane, little Cessna 140, became a little accordion. And they had just recently installed shoulder harnesses. The plane had not had shoulder harnesses. They were in 2 days or we'd have been killed. But the shoulder harnesses held us there while the rest of the plane just became a little ball of metal. And so I saw God's hand leading step by step in this, seemed to be this accident-prone life. And then I'm working on an airplane just before finishing aviation maintenance, and the mechanic tells me, pull up on this wire with both hands. And I'm pulling with a needle-nose wire, and all of a sudden the wire breaks, and with both hands I drive this needle-nose right into my left eye. I saw an explosion of red. I knew my flying days were over. I got on my knees. I said, oh, Lord, oh, Lord. I knew I was going to stick my finger in, and you can imagine, like when you stick it into a plum, that's what I expected to happen. I expected my finger to go deep into my eye and all the fluid run out. When I felt the eye was still there, I couldn't see anything. I went to looked in the mirror, and I could see there was a big old hole in the side. The pliers had gone in, gone sideways, and come out the side. God gave me back my eyesight again. I was saying to myself, man, I don't even own my own eyes anymore. God must have something for me, so if I'm going to fly, I better give my life to the Lord. I had a job offer to fly. I was flying a cabin class aircraft for a coal company, and the owner of the airplane would spend about $8,000 a week on plane. He'd go pick up one girlfriend, take her to the ball game, go down to Florida, drop her off, pick up another girlfriend elsewhere, and I would fly with him. I was their kind of relief pilot. And I was studying maintenance, and I do the weekend flying. I told him, you know, from Friday night sundown, don't ever get me caught there, because I'm gonna land the airplane, and you're gonna get stuck there because I'm not flying it, and I'm not gonna serve alcohol either. And so he said, well, the only reason I put up with you, David, as a pilot, he said, is because I'm going to hell and I know it. But when you're flying, I know God's gonna take care of you, so I'll put up with it. When I finished, he offered me a very good job with tremendous benefits, but my life wasn't mine anymore. I realized that I wouldn't be flying if it weren't for God's mercy, and I certainly wouldn't be alive without His miracles. So we accepted a call to Mexico, and I remember flying the Cessna 185 there. The hospital had a little runway by the side, and I got pretty good at taking off, landing every day. But one day I came back, and I find a heavy rain had just gone through, and it was all wet. Well, I'd been landing and taking off so much, and I'd never had really a problem, so I went ahead and landed. And there was a strong crosswind, and as I kept going right down to the center of the runway, I realized this plane was getting closer and closer to the edge of the runway, so I kept kind of turning sideways. You know what a car does when it's snow. You all know about snow. Man, it was just like landing on ice. And as it got closer, I kept going sideways, and pretty soon I was going 45 degrees getting down the center of the runway, and then the next thing confronted me. There was a fence at the end of the runway, and it was coming up very fast. And I realized I was already going 45 degrees down the center of the runway. What would it hurt to turn all the way around? There was no brakes. So I went ahead and pushed the plane around, and I was going backward at 40 miles an hour. And I added full power with 300 horsepower, and that plane went, came to stop 10 feet from the fence. It always takes the first time. I mean, I don't care how much experience you have, there's always some experience that'll mature you, keeps you humble. So that day when I came back from a long day of flying and I found the runway wet, I wasn't about to land there. I landed on the road, and I left the plane parked off the side of the road. I got our security guard from the hospital to spend the night in the airplane. Never did know that the next morning when he knocked on my door and said, Capitan, Capitan! You have soldiers around your airplane. I took all the papers. I went over there with the director of education for the conference. We showed them everything, but I guess they wanted the airplane because they put a gun in our back. They took us to an abandoned runway, blindfolded us, handcuffed us against the wall, told them, shoot them if they move. Then they interrogated us on and off all day long, put us in a pickup truck, drug us over the mountains, put us in a military prison. Then finally, a couple days later, we ended up in a civil prison, a federal prison. And at that point, we discovered what the whole thing was about. They wanted the airplane, so they were willing to accuse us of drug traffic in order to keep the airplane. And we made the front paper, said the Adventist Church was a center for drug traffickers in southern Mexico. They listed 15 types of drugs they found in the airplane. I thought, boy, this is really a big business. Well, it was rather traumatic because in Mexico you have an automatic 14-year sentence for that. And the union sent their legal man down right away. And he told us, I don't think we're going to get you out. They intend to keep you here and they intend to keep the airplane. And I had to come up with a decision. Do I negotiate with God? Do I tell him, if you get me out of here, I'll trust you? Or do I say, I'll trust you whether you get me out of here or not? And I wrestled with that for a couple of days, and I finally decided, you know, what about the martyrs? You know, they're tied to the stake, and you're going to say, if you get me out of here, I'll trust you. They trusted God even though they lost their life. And so I made the decision, I'm going to trust you even if I don't get out of here. And I resolved that in my mind. And I'm glad I did, because if it ever happens to me again, and it will someday to all of us, possibly we're going to face that choice. We have to come to that decision. Are we going to trust God whether we feel like it, whether things go our way or not? Well, it wasn't long till they asked me, Sabbath came along, and I was asked if I was going to do something for Sabbath. And I said, well, they won't let us have church service here, so why don't we ask permission to have health lectures? I went right away to the prison director, and he handed me the microphone and said, sure, make the announcement. So I made the announcement. Tomorrow at 9:30, we're going to have health lectures. Everybody came. The guards were nervous. They all surrounded us. And we spoke on health and God's plan, 8 natural remedies. And immediately patients started to come. And man, there were so many sick people. The director gave me a little office, medical office there, a dispensary. And I started playing doctor. I didn't want to be a doctor. I don't want to be a doctor. I'm happy being a nurse. But I had to play doctor. And I saw 50 patients a day. And some of them needed surgery. And so I called our medical director, a board certified surgeon. He came down with his sterile packs. And the guard was going to, and I was looking through the bars, and he looked at me and said, Capitan, I hate to see you on the other side of the bars like that. And I was looking through the bars, you know, and I saw the security open up all the sterile, starting to open up all the sterile packages. And I told them, you can't open up the sterile packages. Those are sterile. They're for surgery. Since when do I take orders from prisoners? He said. And I said, you'll take it from the director in a minute. I called the director and I said, look, he's opening the sterile packs, and we brought the doctor in. And so the director turned to him and said, didn't you hear, Mr. Gates? He said, don't open them. Now, don't open them. He brought them all in, and we did about 15 minor surgeries for 2 days, and he went back again. And one day, all of the wives of all the pastors of the mission brought me all this food, and the prison guard said, who's all this food for? That's for Capitan Gates. You know, they call all the pilots Capitan, right? So they made an announcement, Capitan Gates, please come and collect your food. So I came up to the guard. The guard said, excuse me, what are you doing here? I said, you just paged me. Oh, excuse me. They gave me the food, and I saw the prison director pull him off to the side and says, you never salute a prisoner. But they said, Capitan. Exactly. Next time, don't give a title. Prisoners don't have titles. One of the prisoners there needed some food. He came to me and goes, I belong to your church. Can you share the food with me? I said, you do? You belong to my church? I mean, you don't have to belong to my church for me to share the food with you. He said, yes, I belong to your church. And I didn't believe he did. So I said, well, does that mean you don't eat fish on Fridays? Oh, no, I don't eat fish on Fridays. And you eat pork every Saturday? Every Saturday I eat pork. It was a difficult experience. My wife didn't know what was happening. She didn't know where I was at the beginning, but she said the peace of God filled her, that God was in control. And at some point, when she realized we were going to be there for 14 years, it became rather traumatic. And I decided to trust the Lord whether I got out or not. But the legal director for the union came, and he said, you wouldn't believe what happened. This medical work you've been doing here, the food you've been bringing in, the Dorcas clothes you've been sharing with all the prisoners, the prison director is so impressed with Adventists, he's gone to court. And he's told them these Adventists are absolutely innocent, impossible that they're guilty. And because of that, they've dropped the charges. And you can go free. I'll tell you, when I was taking care of those patients, I didn't feel like taking care of patients. They would tell me, it hurts here, it hurts here, I'm having this problem. Inside, you know what I was feeling? Why do I care, buddy, what you're feeling? Do you think I'm hurting inside too? But I realized, love is not always an emotion, it's an action. And so I would go along my duty of taking care of their needs, even though inside I was hurting and being torn apart myself. But God was teaching me that in serving others, you yourself are freedom. And I learned that when you do good to others, regardless of how you feel inside, it comes back again to be a blessing to you. I live life on the front lines, and I keep my angel pretty busy. In Peru, after we left Mexico, we went to Peru. I was director of computer services for the union for 6 years there. Lima is a very large city, and I was constantly getting myself in trouble and being in the wrong part of town at the wrong time. I came in from a trip on a bus, got there about 7 a.m. I'd been traveling all night. I had to walk about 5 blocks to get to a taxi, and I looked around, man, and there was no taxis anywhere. So I started walking, and I had to go to the bathroom. I had to empty my bladder, and I was getting desperate. If I hadn't been in a suit, I would have just gone on the street corner like everybody else. But not in a suit. So I was looking around for where could I go? You know, and I was ready to cry almost. And I saw up an alley, there was a little building that looked like a public toilet, and there was a man standing there, so I probably had to pay him. So I kind of looked around, nobody was watching, so I ran up the alley. I gave the guy a little nickel, ran inside to the bathroom. By the time I positioned myself into a helpless position, I heard a commotion outside. And I looked, and there's this guy with a red bandana and a sword, wild-looking eyes, came running at me, and he ran with the sword, and he was obviously going to run me through with it. Man, what could I do? You know, I would have gone to the bathroom even if I hadn't needed to go to the bathroom. Just about the time he was ready to get me with the sword, he looked up past me. I was the only one standing there. There was nobody else in a little bathroom there. He looked up. His mouth fell open. He got so scared, he put the sword down, and he went in the corner and stood like a little child. I looked behind my back. I didn't see anybody. I could only imagine what he saw. And I quickly zipped up and grabbed my briefcase, and when I walked out, the guy outside, his mouth fell open. He didn't expect me to walk out. And I quickly ran up the street. I thought, man, what do I do to my poor angels, always having to keep track of me? But it wasn't just a week later till my car broke down right in the middle of the worst part of town at evening, full of computers, and I got assaulted by a bunch of guys walking around the car with big rocks, and I was by myself, and I said, Lord, you know, it's good to die for your friend, but it's not good to die for the computers. And I said, these belong to the church, and I just can't release them like that, but I can't give my life for these computers, so if you want to take care of your equipment, that's up to you. I took a step backwards, and a man laid his hand on my shoulder. I jumped because I certainly didn't see anybody near me when I was looking for help, and I saw the most perfect face I have ever seen. It was so perfect that I forgot about the assault, and I kind of imagined I was watching TV. I said, now, maybe that could be Robert Redford. If he was on TV, he would be a movie star. But on the street, I have never seen a perfect face on the street. And while I was trying to analyze his face, he says, your life is in danger, you have to leave. Well, I know. But I don't have a starter. I said, I sent it off to get rebuilt. I have a car full of stuff. You're going to have to push me, you by yourself. It took 3 men to get me started. You can't push me by yourself. And if you tried to push me, the guys would assault you. I looked at them, and they were all frozen there. They kind of related to Lot's wife. They were just standing there holding these big old jagged rocks, and all of them, none of them were moving. He went to the back. I got inside. He pushed me. The car started. I gave him a tip. He didn't want a tip. I don't need money. I said, I always give a tip. So he took it begrudgingly. He said, get out of here. I pulled out, and when my car got hot, because it was out of water, of course, I pulled into a gas station a couple of blocks later, and I realized right then who it was. God had sent his angel again. From Peru, we went to Guyana, to Trinidad and Tobago. I taught at Caribbean Union College. I taught computer science and some graduate classes, business graduate class, graduate business classes for Andrews University. After several years there, we decided it was time to go back to the States for permanent return for our kids. It was time for college. But on the last trip I made to Guyana, the conference administration invited me to travel in to visit the Davis Indians. I had heard about the Davis Indians, but I didn't know where they were. So when I went into the interior to visit them, I found these lovely Indians there. They're the ones that we hear about, you know, that the angel visited them and taught them all about health, about the Sabbath, about diet, about clothing. And then Elder Davis, the mission president, went in, took 6 weeks by boat to get there. He taught them all about the church, and he was a white man with a black book there, had been waiting for. And then he died. His body is still buried there by the mountain, bottom of Mount Roraima, that divides Brazil, Guyana, and Venezuela. And then other missionaries came, and I had heard about the miracles and what had happened, but here I was standing among them, and they said, you know, we haven't had a missionary for 30 years. We would love to have a missionary again. Well, I went back to Trinidad, and I told my wife, you know, our girls have and two boys have never experienced what you and I experienced as children, living out in the bush. We're living in universities and cities and so on. Why don't we take them for a year? The church has been so good to us, given a salary all these years. Let's move into the interior and just be volunteers for a year. And what are we going to eat? Well, you and I just finished reading about George Mueller. This God that gave George Mueller his food, why couldn't he also do it for us? And Hudson Taylor with the Inland China Mission had 100 families living by faith. Why don't we experience God firsthand? I mean, our kids are getting ready to leave home. Isn't it time that we experience God firsthand instead of just living from our paycheck to paycheck? We believe God exists and we believe his promises, but let's put it to the test. If it's for real, I need to know about it now. If it's not for real, the sooner we find out, the better, so we can move on with life. So my union president was pretty nervous. He said, yes, that's okay. We can vote a permanent return for you, but going to live in 200 miles in the interior, you're all going to die. What are you going to do if you have health problems? What are you going to eat? How are you going to educate your kids? And so on. But we went. They were happy to see us go, but scared for us. We were kind of scared too. When I got my last paycheck, I felt like I jumped off of a cliff. And I don't know if some of you have probably experienced that. But we went in there, and the first day came, and we went hungry that night. But when the Indians found out we were hungry, they started bringing food every morning. And we had food to eat. And then when it was time for medicines, we had to buy some medicines with a little bit of savings we had. It was quite difficult to give up the last little bit of cash. But we did it. And within a few days, some visitors showed up and left us twice as much cash as we spent. So we spent it again. And another visitor showed up and left us more cash. And we were getting the idea. The more you give, the more you get. And that's God's plan for us. It's for us to be funnels. You know, you open up, pours into you, you shove it out. And I was beginning to develop a philosophy, you know. Once you run out of money, then you can ask God for more. As long as you have something, why ask him? You know, as long as you have a big bunch of savings, why do you need to go to God and say, I need more money? You haven't used what you got already. So we started this philosophy. As soon as we received it, we started putting it into God's work. And as soon as we received it, we could go back to him and ask for more, and he would fill it up again. They had no Adventist education in Guyana, no secondary or primary schools. And the Indians certainly didn't have anything, even from the government. So we began building a secondary school. The money came in for the gasoline, the chainsaws. It came time to register for classes. We announced everybody, and teachers, no teachers. And the Indians said, well, how are you going to teach classes? They're registering for class and you don't have teachers. I said, the same God who built the school can provide the teachers. I went over to Caribbean Union College. I had the sermon there, and two couples from Martinique, French couples, they volunteered to be our first teachers, and they came across. They just came to me and said, we felt impressed to go, and classes opened as scheduled. It kept growing, and finally the point where the school was going, it's been going for 4 years now, and we have 10 volunteers from Southern there, and we have One student missionary from Walla Walla, and I hope it'll keep growing more, because it's really a neat experience to share the different experiences with college. But when the Indian chiefs started coming in to my village and saying, can you come to my village? Can you do for me in our village what you've done here? And I said, where are you from? Oh, not very far at all. Only 4 days walking in this direction. That's four for him, five for me, no doubt. And I'd be walking for 10 days and still haven't done anything. So I realized God didn't give me aviation for nothing. It's time to think about an airplane. So we prayed about it and prayed about it, and it came time to, hey, you know what? We're going to have to go buy an airplane. We just can't talk about it. There were 5 frogs on a log. 4 of them decided to jump off. How many frogs are left? How many? Somebody says 5, and that's correct. There were 5 frogs left. Why? Because there's a big difference between deciding and doing. You can decide all you want. You can make all the decisions you want. But if you don't do anything with it, you haven't done anything. So if we're going to be deciding to buy an airplane, what do you have to do? You have to go buy an airplane. So I went to the States. I had a ticket left over. I was a man of little faith. I took all my tickets with me just in case the Lord wasn't faithful, I would have a way home. And so I had my ticket, and I was learning God was faithful, but I still had my ticket. So I took it to the States. I bought a trade plane, thousands of magazines, and I started looking to them. And as I was looking at them, I found the right one. I called on the phone, I negotiated a price, and I got in my car to get ready to go. And my dad says, "I can't believe you called and negotiated a price and you don't even have any money." I said, "That's not my problem. My problem is to find the right airplane and to go see it, and only when I get there, then God has to give me the money." I was learning God likes to take us right up to the edge before He comes through. You know, He does that to me all the time. Well, a short-tail relative there, a relative of my brother-in-law, said to me, she said, "I know you don't have any money, and my husband and I, we feel like God has impressed us to loan you the money, and you can pay it back whenever God gives you back the money." So I took the money that God provided, I went and bought the airplane, and within 90 days, without telling anybody about it, money came in to pay for it all, and I gave her back all her money in 90 days. And so I saw God moving forward. As we move forward, we got to do what we humanly possibly can. We can't wait for God to kick us out of the bed every morning. We got to get up on our own, right? That's what He gave us energy for. He gives you intelligence. He gives you education. He expects you to do what you can do, but He will certainly come through. It's a game of tennis I play with God. I keep the ball in His court as much as possible. And then I wait for Him to get back. I don't want Him waiting on me. That's what He does all the time. God is waiting all the time on His church to do something. But once we do what we can do, we can wait for Him to tell us what to do next. But it takes always, you're outside of your comfort zone. And we learned that as it grows, as we move forward, God provides. The program has grown now to include 2 boarding academies. I just purchased an airplane in Venezuela. We have 2 airplanes for Guyana, 2 single-engine airplanes, 1 twin-engine airplane, which we use to fly the long range. And then we just bought a 4th airplane in Venezuela just 2 weeks ago. I had to borrow most of the money to buy it because I find that I have to do my part first. I put the down payment, and the guy said, "Now I'm ready for the rest of it," and I didn't have so much. So I went ahead and did it, and just yesterday I received a phone call that 2/3 of that loan has already come in already. It's one check. It seems like only when you move forward and do your part, then God does His part. Over and over and over again. What does it tell us about us, huh? Have you done your part yet? Or are you waiting for God to do His part? God wants you to do what you can do, and He will fulfill the need. Have you ever read any Sherlock Holmes stories? Have you ever read the story of the 2% solution? I used to like to read Sherlock Holmes when I was in academy. The 2% solution, about a poison solution. I'm going to tell you about the 1% solution now. You remember reading in Judges about Gideon? He got 32,000 people volunteer to fight. And God said, "Too many." So he had 10,000 left over. Still too many. So he got rid of the rest of them. He only had 300 left out of 32,000 men, approximately 1%. I was in Lima one time, standing in front of the union office, and there's 4 lanes this way and 4 lanes coming this way, and the lights were out. And there was a traffic jam, and nobody was giving way. And the director of education and myself were standing up front, and I said, "This is crazy. I mean, not a single car will give way." And so they're all stuck there with horns. You know, nobody would give way. So I said, "Have you ever seen me be a policeman?" He said, "No, I never saw you. Were you a policeman?" I said, "No, but you watch me be a policeman now." So I walked out to the middle of that big intersection, and I looked, and I could see there was only one car that could turn. No other car could move. I told that lady, "Please turn right here." She says, "No, I don't want to go that way. I want to go that way." I said, "I need you to turn right here so that the rest of the cars can come." She goes, "I don't want to go that way. I need to go that way." "Lady, if you don't turn right now, I'm taking you down to the police station." "Yes, sir," she said. She turned. we got that flowing, and then another row, and pretty soon all eight lanes were traveling pretty well. And I went back, and he said, "Boy, you do things. I don't know if I could ever have the courage to do that." And it taught me something that I want to bring to an example for you. Today, God is looking for a people. And just like in Gideon's time, he doesn't need a big crowd. He just needs a small group. Our church very soon will reach 14 million. And it doesn't take a genius to figure out what 1% is. 144,000 is approximately 1%. Of the other 99%, not necessary. It'd be nice to have, but it's not necessary to finish the job. I don't know if that 144,000 is literal or symbolic. It doesn't matter. What's important is God only needs 1%. A lot of us here today are pretty miserable trying to straddle with one foot in the world and the other in a church, trying to play a dual game. It's kind of a miserable. Have you ever done the splits with standing on a boat and watch the boat go further like this from shore? It's not very much fun to try to be in the world and be in a church. It's miserable. They just did a survey in one of the islands down in the Caribbean, and they found out that, as you would expect, that Adventists in that island live longer than anybody else. But they also found that they're not some of the happiest people on the island. That's not very good. And it's hard playing the splits. I would like to propose to you today that it's time now for you to make a decision in your life. I would like to propose to you that you either make a decision to get hot or you leave because you're blocking traffic. We don't need a traffic jam in the church. Jesus is about ready to come. We've already had a warning shot across our bow. It's called September 11. Nothing will be the same again, and it's time we get our act together and decide what side you're on. When I took world history, I read a book called The Prince by Machiavelli. Not a very good book. It talks about lying and cheating and politics and what you have to do to survive. But there's one thing that he said that was right. You have to choose sides. You can't be neutral. You've got to choose sides. Most of our church today is neutral and sleeping. And very soon, those that are neutral and sleeping are going to be vomited out of the mouth. And I'll tell you what, you don't want to be vomited. It's much better that you leave the church than to be neutral when that time comes. I think it's time for us to choose. Once there's the little group left, with God's Spirit poured out, like lightning, the work will be finished. God wants quality. He doesn't want quantity. He loves quantity. It would be great if all of us, the whole church, all 14 million, were to be able to get red hot. But unfortunately, that does not the average. That's not usually what happens. Inside of each of your heads is a switch today. It's a little switch called commitment. Choice. You can flip that switch on, and God knows you flipped it. I have a cousin, and her father, my uncle, made some decisions that weren't too wise. He ran off with a teenage girl, a friend of my cousin's, and she said, if an Adventist can do that, then I don't even believe there's a God. She left the church. She started seeing a psychiatrist. She had to leave college. She married cross-racially, had violence in the home. It was just a disaster, and her life was just going spiraling downhill. So I went over to visit her. And I'm her favorite cousin. She was my flower girl in our wedding. She was kind of jealous of my wife. And so I knew that I had an inside track. So I took her window shopping, we went to the mall, and finally I said, you know, I know you don't believe in God, but would you do me a favor? She says, what? Would you get up every morning and tell God, I don't believe you exist? What? I'm supposed to get up and tell God that he doesn't exist? I said, that's what you're supposed to tell him. Every morning, I don't believe you exist, God, but just in case you do, I give you permission to work in my life. She said, what good will that do? I said, absolutely nothing if God doesn't exist. But if God does exist, and I believe he does, I'm convinced that he does, I've experienced it myself, all you have to do is give him permission to work in your life, and he's going to change your life and take it over. But there's no risk to you since you don't believe in God anyhow. Okay, I'll do it for you, she said. A few months later, my aunt called me and said, what did you do to that girl? She's not seeing a psychiatrist anymore. She's enrolled in college again. She still has big scars in her life. She's working through problems, but everything is coming back into order again. She's healing again. And I believe that's all God is looking for today, is your permission to change your life. Get up in the morning. You don't have to have all your act together. You don't have to make it perfect. You don't have to even say, I've done so many things wrong, I better make them right before. Just like you are. Just come to God and say, I give you permission to work in my life today. I'm defective. I'm weak. I got problems. I got commitments. I don't know how I'm going to get out of this, but you got control of my life. Whatever you have to do, do to me. And he's going to start cleaning up your life, and he's going to make you useful. He has a plan for you, a beautiful plan. In fact, if you ever had dreams, that's the dreams he has for you. If you wanted to be successful and be influential and have love and joy and success, that is what God is dreaming for you too. But we have an enemy called the devil, and I mean, he wants to destroy this generation. I'm looking at a lot of people right now that are going to see Jesus coming, I'm convinced. Most of us. We're the young crowd. And in a few months, I say months because I like it better than years. In a few months, we're going to see Jesus coming. And I'm going to be ready. And I'm telling the whole world that it's time to get ready. But mainly, my message is for the Adventist Church. Those who know the truth and aren't living it. Those who are just playing with the world. We have no time to play anymore. Give God your music. Give God your reading material. Your viewing material. Just tell him he can have control of it. Let him clean it up. It's not your job to clean up your life. You can't do it anyhow. All you can do is surrender. And by surrendering, you win. I'm very aggressive when it comes to evangelism. And I'm penetrating deep into Venezuela and to Guyana and other countries. And we're just going from island to island and putting it up. And I'm just so excited that God pulled me deep out of the jungles. Who am I? A nobody. But he did so much for me that people are just dying to see God once again. And I have a message, and I'm here today. I accepted his invitation and the preaching appointments. And I was in Vermont last weekend, this weekend here, next week in Arkansas. The following weekend, I'll be with the Southern Union administrators for 5 days. And then I'm back to Guyana again, and then over to Venezuela, and then to Peru, and then to Bolivia, and then back again. I don't like traveling. I like being on my farm with the family. I would love to be with my family just relaxing. But I got to tell my story. The story is Jesus is coming back. He wants to take control of his people. You got to make some decisions. You cannot float into the kingdom. There has to be some decisions. Machiavelli was right. Which side are you on? What choice are you going to make today? I'm not going to ask you to stand up. It's that switch in your head. I invite you today. Tell the Lord right now, Lord, I choose yes. And do it every morning. Just give God permission. He's just dying to have a chance to work in your life. If you do that, you watch what happens in your life. The changes will start happening. Things will start cleaning up. Some of these problems that you can't resolve, he'll resolve. And if you think everything's going well, you don't have any problems, you haven't seen nothing yet. Just wait a few more months and see what happens. It's about to happen to you. I wanted to share my joy and peace with you today. I hope it's yours. I hope that you've made that choice, or you will make that choice. I hope today you make that choice. And I'd like to hear from you. I wasn't sure when I was going to come back again. It looks like it'll be for the family camp. It'll be at Upper Columbia Academy for the family camp meeting. It won't be this camp meeting coming up. I will be in Auburn Academy for June. But if I run across you or I see you again, and you've made your choice, tell me about it. I'm just thrilled when people make their decision. It's time to be mission-driven. It's time to commit everything. And the last final thing I'm going to leave with you is, do you know that nothing you own is yours? Did you know that? Your money, your cars, your house, your influence, your education. Without brains that God gave you, you can never even get an education. Your resources, everything you own, everything you have doesn't even belong to you. And the sooner you learn to detach yourself from your belongings and let go, the easier it is to walk away. When you look at that, one of these days soon, we're going to have to look at everything, we're going to have to turn our back on it, and we're going to have to walk away from it all. It's impossible to do unless you detach yourself emotionally first. Today, you can start detaching. If you have things you're hanging on to, start learning to let go and walk away from it. If God wants you to walk away, or he wants you to invest it, if he wants you to use it for him, give it. If he says, put it in the offering plate. If he says, use it to be a blessing to others, give it to another student. They need it worse than you. Or take your time. I know you don't have time. I know you have an exam. But that student needs a little help right now. It's time to start detaching ourselves from our things and start recognizing that all we are is just a manager. And once you do that, the rest of it's easy. I want to thank you for the invitation today. I want to thank the administration. I praise God for this opportunity, and I praise God for you. And I hope your life will be one of those changes and stand up for the right, be aggressive, make a difference. Don't just get a job. You know there's a job to do. I hope you're not getting an education here just so you can get a job. Anybody can do that. You're getting an education so you can do a job. That's why you're here. Get out there and do it. I'll be standing by your side, and I'll be praying with you, and I hope you experience that same experience of living on the front lines. There's a tree right on the edge of a cliff. I fly by it all the time. It's growing out like this. And then when I come back in the evenings back home, I fly right by that cliff, just about as close as I can fly, so I can look at that tree. And it takes the storms. It's the first one to see the sun up and the last one to see the sun go down. It lives right on the edge of the little cliff. There's a little ledge, and it's right there all by itself. And every time I fly by it, I say to myself, that's me, living life right on the edge. You can have that same experience too, and I hope you do. God bless.